Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a just-released report from the World Meteorological Organization that finds the global warming gas CO2 grew more rapidly last year than its average rise over the past decades. Meteorologist Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of The Hockey Stick and The Climate Wars, joins us to discuss the report and his own wars with the just-defeated candidate for governor, Virginia's Attorney General Cuccinelli, who began a witch hunt against Michael Mann, accusing the climate scientist of fraud. Then, with the poor being punished by cuts in food stamps, we will look into how the unemployed are about to be punished, with 1.3 million Americans losing unemployment insurance at the end of the year, according to a new report from the National Employment Law Project. The author of that report, Rebecca Dixon, joins us to discuss the chronic federal underfunding of states' unemployment programs, burdened by extensive backlogs and outdated and unreliable systems, which in California alone have delayed payments on 300,000 claims. Then finally, we will discuss oral arguments in the Supreme Court on an important church versus state case with Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, who has an article at the Daily Beast, Supreme Court Prayer Decision in Greece versus Galloway Should Be Easy. Joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org, and in 2007 he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Hi, it's good to be with you, Ian.
And Michael, I had no idea that you were in the midst of climate wars against this anti-science zealot, Ken Cuccinelli, the Attorney General of the state of Virginia, who just lost the race for governorship. He went on this jihad, this witch hunt against you starting in 2010. Tell our audience about what happened, how he wasted thousands of the taxpayers' money in the state of Virginia on a crusade against a climate scientist, charging you with fraud.
Sure, yeah. He, in fact, forced the University of Virginia to spend the better part of $500,000, and who knows how much taxpayer money he actually spent in this over the course of this crusade. Ken Cuccinelli is, you know, a classic so-called Tea Party Republican. He has ultra-conservative views on a range of topics, and he's a denier of climate change. He denies the basic science of climate change. And what he tried to do was to accuse me of fraud because I was working on the science of climate change, and he considers that science fraudulent, of course, because it doesn't comport with his ideological views. And so he tried to use this what's known as a civil subpoena as Attorney General to force the university to turn over thousands of emails between me and 39 different climate scientists around the world, presumably so he could find something to embarrass us with. After all, you know, he was the recipient of quite a bit of fossil fuel money that fund his campaigns. So this was widely seen for what it was by reasonable people as an effort by a fossil fuel-funded politician to intimidate scientists whose findings, you know, might be inconvenient to the special interests that he represents. And the courts, the lower court rejected it. He appealed to the state Supreme Court. It rejected the case with prejudice, meaning that they really didn't want to see him ever come back to the court with something like that again. And so it was, I was relieved that he was defeated yesterday. In fact, I actively campaigned with his opponent, Terry McAuliffe, over the past several months because I understood what a stark contrast this race represented. On the one hand, you have Terry McAuliffe, who believes in science and technology and innovation and recognizes that's the way we're going to grow the economy, and Ken Cuccinelli, who sees science as something to attack if it doesn't comport with his ideological views.
So, Michael Mann, if you were stumping for Terry McAuliffe, what was your impression of how your arguments are being received? Because the problem is that we live in a culture where the truth is a moving target, where people do reality shopping, and right, faith sometimes trumps fact.
That's right. Yeah, and that's why we really have to fight back against the efforts to mislead the public, disinformation campaigns like those funded by the fossil fuel industry to confuse the public about the science. That's why I've argued that scientists play an important role in trying to inform this discourse and trying to cut through the nonsense and the disinformation and the falsehoods that are promoted by front groups for the fossil fuel industry, groups working for the Koch brothers, who are doing their best to confuse the public about basic issues of science, like the science of climate change, because they find it inconvenient, the notion that we have to do something about our escalating carbon emissions.
Well, you have to add to the list of the Koch brothers, Rupert Murdoch, the owner of many newspapers and Fox News. He just helped get this climate denier in Australia, elected Prime Minister.
Right.
Now, on the
That's
platform
right.
of climate denial against the carbon tax that was enacted by the previous government.
That's right. And in fact, in Australia, of course, Murdoch controls much of the media, but he has a controlling interest in News Corp, which means in the U.S., the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, in the U.K., a number of tabloids. He has a huge media empire in the form of News Corp, and he's using that media empire to, again, to disinform the public, to confuse the public. Now, here's one thing that most people don't realize, they're not aware of. News Corp has a controlling interest when you combine Rupert Murdoch and the second largest shareholder, which is Kingdom Holding. That's the Saudi royal family. Together with Rupert Murdoch, they have a controlling share of News Corp, and they are using that media empire to basically to confuse the public about the threat of climate change. It's a deeply immoral activity that they are engaged in.
So the Saudis, because they're an oil economy, they're against global warming because they want to keep selling fossil fuels. And Murdoch's got a climate change denier now as Prime Minister of Australia. So
it's
amazing,
isn't
it?
Or the other place, perhaps. Yep.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org, and in 2007 he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include...
Well, technically, I should be careful with the wording there. We contributed to the award of the Nobel Peace Prize.
I see. You didn't share in the loot.
We didn't actually get, a gold medal, no.
Okay, all right. But your books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines.
Yes.
Let's turn to the reason I was calling you, although I was so blown away when I found out that Cuccinelli had been on this jihad against you.
Yeah, a lot of news today. Yep.
So let's talk about the report that just came out from the World Meteorological Organization saying that the atmospheric CO2 grew more rapidly last year than its average rise over the past decades, and thanks to carbon dioxide and methane and other gases, the World Meteorological Organization says that the warming effect on our climate has increased by almost a third since 1990.
Yeah, that's right. We are, most people don't realize that we are actually escalating in our burning of fossil fuels and our generation of greenhouse gases because it isn't just industrial nations like the U.S. Who are burning fossil fuels and contributing to greenhouse gas emissions, but now we have developing nations like China and India and South America coming online with their own fossil fuel economies. And so global greenhouse gas emissions are increasing exponentially. It isn't just a constant rate of increase. The rate of increase is increasing. And that's why we project that if we continue with business as usual, fossil fuel burning, we will reach levels of CO2 in the atmosphere double their pre-industrial levels within a matter of decades. Now, here's something else. Earlier this year, we, for the first time on record, exceeded 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. For every million parts of atmosphere, 400 of them were CO2. Now, that may not sound like a large concentration, but pre-industrial levels were only 280, and we have to go back several million years to find levels of CO2 that exceeded that level, where CO2 was 400 parts per million in the atmosphere. We have to go back several million years to find CO2 concentrations that high. So we are engaged in this unprecedented experiment, this uncontrolled experiment, in the way that we are changing the composition of the atmosphere, warming the planet, and changing the climate.
So the World Meteorological Organization's report that just came out says, it points out that we exceeded the symbolic 400 parts per million in May of this year. But it also says that the global annual average of CO2 concentration will cross that threshold in 2015 or 2016. So we're definitely on the wrong track, right?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a large annual sort of cycle in CO2 levels as the world's plants collectively breathe in from the atmosphere and they breathe out. It's called the breathing of the biosphere. The Earth, like us, breathes in and breathes out with the seasons. And so CO2 concentrations are highest in the Northern Hemisphere summer. They come down in the Northern Hemisphere winter as plants stop photosynthesizing and taking in CO2. And we so there's this annual cycle, and we reached the peak of that annual cycle earlier this summer, and that peak went above 400 parts per million. Now it's coming back down. It'll go back up next summer, and it'll continue to wiggle. But on top of that wiggle is riding on an ever-upward trend. And so we hit the 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere for the first time this year during the upswing of that wiggle. But in a matter of a decade or two, we will be there even at the low side of that wiggle. And so we are, you know, we are continuing to ramp up the concentrations of these gases at a rate where, you know, in a couple decades, we will probably be crossing the 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere rather than 400. Why do I cite that number? That is the level of CO2 in the atmosphere we are fairly confident will give us a net warming of the planet of 2 degrees Celsius. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit relative to pre-industrial time. That's enough warming to lead to what can reasonably be described as dangerous and potentially irreversible changes in our climate.
And the rise of the ocean, too. I mean, that...
We, in fact, with the CO2 we are putting into the atmosphere right now, the ocean will continue to... sea levels will continue to rise for centuries because that heating of the atmosphere is slowly sinking into the ocean, down into the deep ocean, and it continues to contribute to sea level rise as those deep ocean waters warm and they expand. So the decisions we are making right now with our fossil fuel burning have implications for centuries to come in terms of the amount of sea level rise we'll see.
Well, Michael Mann, again, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, there's obviously some rather, I consider it quite pernicious, arguments going on in favor of nuclear power as a solution. Some climate scientists seem to have sort of drunk the nuclear industry's Kool-Aid. I'm always amazed at how the nuclear industry can stay in business after Three Mile Island and after Chernobyl and now after Fukushima, but... Something keeps them alive. They're like the ever-ready bunny, you know. But
I actually drove past Three Mile Island earlier today on my way down from State College to Harrisburg. So I'm aware of the impact that meltdown had. And, you know, in Fukushima, what we're doing here is we're trading off risks. They're different kinds of risks. They have different temporal timescales associated with them, different global footprints in terms of the regions that they influence, but there's no question that there are risks associated with nuclear energy as there are risks associated with fossil fuel burning. And the only truly safe route to meeting our growing energy needs is to incentivize clean, non-fossil fuel-based renewable energy like wind and solar and geothermal. There's enough of that to meet growing demands over the decades ahead. There are peer-reviewed scientific studies that show that we could meet 85% of our projected energy demand by 2050 from a combination of wind, solar, and geothermal. So we don't need to employ these riskier these riskier forms of energy generation.
But the other big hoax, I think, that's being played on the American people now, which is being funded by the natural gas lobby, who are buying up a lot of media, a lot of public media too, I might add, and lots of ads now on NPR stations about how fracking and how great it is for farmers making all this money. Right. My understanding is that there isn't really any good data out yet on the extent to which all of this fracking is opening up fissures that emit methane, and that these wellheads are emitting methane, and that this is a reckless system. This fracking has consequences that hasn't been measured. And if this industry can argue, that, which is scientifically factual, that natural gas creates much less pollution than coal, which is a fact, but it's not a win. It's a loss if they release methane, because methane is, what, 100 times worse in terms of global warming gases than CO2. So as far as I know, it's a wash.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it depends on the time scale you're talking about, because the problem with CO2 in particular is it's around for a very long time. Methane tends to disappear. It's scavenged from the atmosphere after a time frame of about a decade or so. So there are different sort of time horizons associated with these two different gases. But the bottom line is that there is a huge uncertainty here about how much methane is leaking into the atmosphere through hydraulic fracturing, fracking. There is not yet a scientific consensus about precisely how much of this fugitive methane is making it into the atmosphere. But what that means is that there is a huge and unknown risk associated with our continued reliance on natural gas under the assumption that somehow it's going to lower our net greenhouse gas emissions. As you allude to, while natural gas does produce less CO2 than coal per unit of power generated, about a factor or two less, that could easily be offset by the amount of methane that's put into the atmosphere. And there are other what we call externalities, environmental externalities, the damage potentially done to groundwater, the contamination of groundwater by the fracking process, by the chemicals that are used in fracking. And so what we have to look at the full footprint of environmental impacts associated with each of these methods of getting energy. And it isn't just the greenhouse gases put into the atmosphere. It's the environmental damage that's done, whether it's groundwater contamination in the case of fracking, whether it's destroying entire mountain ecosystems by blowing up the tops of mountains to get the coal that's buried underneath, or destroying the environment, the surrounding environment, by mining the tar sands up in Canada. Each of these fossil fuel-based energy sources has associated with it, a number of potential environmental impacts that we can't even truly evaluate. How do you put a dollar number on the value of the Gulf of Mexico and the ecosystems that it supports? How do you put a dollar value on the value of a mountain wilderness? How do you put a dollar value on, the Athabascan Plains of Canada? So we have to think about the true cost, the hidden cost of many of these sources of fossil fuel energy.
Well, I thank you for joining us here. And just in closing, the World Meteorological Organization's report that we're discussing here also says that concentrations of methane and nitrous oxide have broken previous records. So I thank you for joining us, Michael Mann.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he contributed to those who shared the Nobel Peace Prize on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how, after food stamps have been cut for the poor, now the unemployed are about to take a hit.
At least it's not the end of the world.
would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rebecca Dixon, a policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. Her work includes research, analysis, and advocacy in support of state and federal unemployment insurance reform, and she previously worked as a policy analyst for the Mississippi Economic Policy Center. She is the author of the National Employment Law Project's new report titled State Unemployment Systems in State of Disrepair. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Dixon.
Hello, Ian. Thank you for having me on.
And, Rebecca, it just seems a cruel and unusual punishment here that after 47 million Americans receiving food stamps, and these include a lot of children, and the poorest among us, the least among us, as the Bible says, have taken this hit last Friday, they're getting less money, and their budget's already overstretched. And by the end of the month, most families run out of food stamps. But the Congress doesn't seem to care. They've cut food stamps. And now I understand, according to your new report, that 1.3 million Americans currently receiving long-term unemployment insurance will abruptly lose their federal benefits sometime after Christmas.
You're right. So we did an analysis, and we looked at the folks who are on benefits right now, and it looks like that 1.3 million will be cut off abruptly at the end of the year, so there won't be a phase-out like there have been in past years. So right around the holidays, they'll lose these vital benefits that they need to keep their utilities on and just pay rent while they look for work. And we also know that by early 2014, more than 2 million people will have lost their benefits. So it's just really a shocking thing with unemployment being still elevated and it being a tough job market for so many people right now.
So, but it seems, though, in the past, in the recent past, that the Congress has come up with solutions. Last year, the Democrats won a continuation of benefits through the so-called fiscal cliff deal. And in 2011, Congress reauthorized benefits to the payroll tax cuts that were expiring. And the year before that, they attached the benefits to an extension of the Bush-era tax cuts for the rich. So what's changed this year? Their hearts have hardened?
It seems that, you know, because this downturn has dragged on for so long and our recovery has been so weak, I think that people are just getting fatigued at the issue, but missing the point of the people who are actually out there looking for work. Lots of record long-term unemployment in this recession. So workers looking for work for 6 months or more, a year or more. And so those workers are fatigued as well, but Congress shouldn't forget those workers when they look at this program at the end of the year.
So what's your reading, though, on where things stand in the Congress? I mean, I take it, well, first of all, the reality of the Congress is that it's controlled by the Republicans, and the Tea Party caucus is fairly hostile to the poor, and it's no secret about that. And they just threatened they succeeded in shutting down the government and threatened to tank the economy. I don't think you can do business with them. Is there enough votes, or who's the champion? Who's going to carry this case, before the Congress, and to try and shame them into doing the right thing? Because at the end of the day, this is chump change, really. You know, they say the deficit's a big problem, but what are we talking about here in terms of money? It's nothing compared to, say, buying one expensive F-35 fighter,
Well, you're exactly right. But benefits have already been cut back significantly already due to the improving economy and also due to cuts that Congress made to the program in previous reauthorizations. So they've cut the weeks down substantially, and lots of states are no longer receiving the benefits because their unemployment rates have fallen. But we do see that there are lots of workers who the unemployment rate has fallen because lots of workers have actually dropped out of the labor force and stopped looking. And so we're hoping that Congress will take this as an opportunity to do the right thing and not react in the ways that they have with the shutdown and the food stamp program, and to go ahead and do the right thing and to think of all of these hardworking Americans and their families who are depending on this program. And this program is really vital to keeping families out of poverty, and it has an effect not just for those people that are receiving the benefits, but for their entire family, including their children's well-being. So it's just a huge effect, and we're going to be working with our partners in Congress and hoping that we can make the case that these benefits are vital, and this is an opportunity for Congress to do the right thing and to not get stuck and to go ahead and do what they were sent to Congress to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Dixon, who's a policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. Her work includes research, analysis, and advocacy in support of state and federal unemployment insurance reform. And she previously worked as a policy analyst for the Mississippi Economic Policy Center. She is the author of the National Employment Law Project's new report titled State Unemployment Systems in State of Disrepair. So let's turn to that subject, and because here in the state of California, we have there's some hearings that are about to take place in the Capitol over this new software that crashed, and I must say it sounds a bit like healthcare.gov in terms of these contractors that seem to screw up. But I don't know the details, and I'm sure you'll fill us in here. But my understanding is that this chronic federal underfunding of the state's unemployment programs, which are burdened by extensive backlogs and outdated and unreliable systems, and here in the state of California alone, these problems have delayed payments on 300,000 claims. So we just got through talking about how the unemployed are going to be cut from the rolls, but those that are receiving benefits aren't receiving them because of, screwed up computer systems. So walk us through. We'll start with the state of California because I know this is a nationwide problem.
Okay, sure. So the state of California's issue is a bit different necessarily from the other states that we talked about in the report, because it seems that a lot of the states don't have the funds to actually redo their computer system. And so in this case, California was able to redo their computer system, but there were lots of problems with it. And from what I've found out, they knew that there were problems with the system, but they launched it anyway. And so there was this huge backlog where people were not able to get their claims. And the way that that's somewhat different from other states is that a lot of the other states actually are operating systems from the 70s or 80s, and so they don't even have a new system. And so we have two problems. We have a problem where states can update their technology, and when they do, they're not able to have the funds to test it properly or to run both systems until they can work out all the kinks, or they just don't have the sort of expertise to be able to make sure that it runs smoothly. And so the California hearing today explored some of those issues, specifically to California. But for other states, it's really this long-term underfunding of their system where their funding doesn't include money to regularly update their technology. And I know that when you get a new computer, our computers are outdated, our home computers are outdated within a few years. So imagine trying to pay benefits with a system from the 70s or 80s. And so states are trying as hard as they can, but we're asking them to do it often with their hands tied behind their back, one hand tied behind their back.
And that's because the federal government is what's happening? Is there money being promised? Is it in the pipeline, or is it just simply not being appropriated?
Well, we have a sort of a historic underinvestment where the funds that they get have not been adjusted for inflation, and there's no money in there for infrastructure upgrades like technology. So no money for capital investments. And so they have these systems, but there's no money in the formula that they get that's there dedicated just to making sure that these systems stay up to date. And so states have been trying to cobble things together as best they can. In some cases, they have put new software and platforms on the front side of these old legacy systems. So you have new technology on the front end, but it's being run by a system that's still being programmed in COBOL. And so, as you can imagine, that just leaves them vulnerable to all kinds of things going wrong when there's any pressure applied to the system, like with the recession, or even we've seen in natural disasters, we've seen that kind of pressure to the system cause lots of problems. And workers are bearing the brunt of this. The Social Security Act gives Congress the responsibility, the Department of Labor, the federal government, to give states the money that they need for the proper and efficient administration of UI programs. And so some states are able to put in their own money, but that's not how the program was designed. And, you know, in a recession, states are cutting, you know, funds for education, and they're cutting public safety and teachers and firefighters, and so they don't have money to add to the system to augment it. And so we've seen just these problems, especially in states where unemployment has remained elevated throughout the recession and recovery.
And again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Dixon, the policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. She is the author of the National Employment Law Project's new report titled State Unemployment Systems in State of Disrepair. So I don't know where the state of California got its $110 million to upgrade its employment development department and with software that's crashed. So again, like healthcare.gov. So do you know where they got it from and why they're having so problem? I guess the real problem is interfacing the new software with the old claim data, right? Is that what's going on?
Right. So they've gotten the funds from the federal government. So states are able to sometimes, you know, save a little money year after year after year. And these systems are very complex. They can take up to 5 years to develop. So from the time that they engage a contractor to create a new system for them, it may be 5 years before the system goes live. And so you can see it's a very huge undertaking. And so if the state is not monitoring the contractor's work and making sure that they're getting their deliverables on time and making sure that it's tested properly, then you can see how things can go wrong.
So tell us about some of the other states then, because I understand that also in California, the phone system is not working. And I don't know exactly how the phones relate to it. I think my understanding is that people on unemployment benefits get something like a credit card, do they not? But because their claims aren't being paid, they're calling in and the phone systems isn't working. Is that just an extra glitch?
Well, it is actually an extra glitch, and part of that being driven by technology problems. Part of it's being driven by the fact that they, you know, according to the state, they don't have the money. So when unemployment falls nationwide, then the funding that they get for administration that all states get starts to fall as well. But the funding is falling much faster than the claims that are falling. And so what happens is states have to figure out how do we deal with this money that we're losing or we're going to lose. And they often lay off staff. And so in California, they've laid off lots of their staff and their call center staff and their staff that processes claims. And so if there's no one there in the chair to answer the phone, then the call can't go through. And there's lots of reasons why workers actually call in, Ian, about their claims. Unemployment insurance is a very complex program. There's lots of rules. And so workers have to file claims each week. They have to certify that they've been looking for work, that they didn't earn any money that week. And so there's often questions that workers have about their claim. And it's important to get those questions answered and to fill out the forms correctly. That prevents overpayments of benefits or underpayments of benefits. And so workers have a timeline in which they have to get the claim put in. If you miss that timeline, you either lose that week of benefits or it's a very difficult process to then go back in and put it in. And so workers need this money. I mean, they're desperate for it. They need it to get to work. They need, you know, to get to job interviews, to have gas in their vehicles, to go on interviews, and to, you know, keep their families afloat while they're searching for work. And so you can see why they're calling. And they, if they can't get through, they're just thinking, you know, if I just keep calling. And so this is wasted time for the states and wasted time for workers who could be using this time to search for work, but instead are desperately trying to get the benefits that they need.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Rebecca Dixon, tell us about the states that have 1970s equipment and how they're obviously even worse off than California.
Well, the way it's been described to me as, you could call it a web of different technology. So, for example, a few years back, Florida had 15 different platforms and softwares attached to their benefit system. And so you can understand that when you have to ramp up, if there's pressure on the system, like with the recession, or if there's a huge layoff in one business and there's a big push where you have to process lots of claims, all of those pieces have to be ramped up. You have to synchronize ramping those up. And so you can see that there's so many opportunities for things to go wrong. And so states are seeing this happen. Other states are also having issues with phones or have had issues with phones in the last year. A lot of it's driven by the layoffs of staff, the same issues with call centers not being able to get through. And in Pennsylvania last year, they have in their offices, you can go into the center where you can search for a job, and there's a phone that goes directly to the call center. And so people were so desperate, they would go early in the morning at 6 a.m. before it even opens, and there'd be a line, and people would be there just to use the phone all day because they needed to get through, and that phone worked, but they couldn't get through from home. So it's just, you can see that in states where the unemployment rate is still elevated, that seems to be where we're having the most problems right now.
Well, Rebecca Dixon, I thank you so much for joining us and filling us in on this. It's very important, and it's going under the radar, and I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Dixon, a policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project. Her work includes research, analysis, and advocacy in support of state and federal unemployment insurance reform, and she previously worked as a policy analyst for the Mississippi Economic Policy Center. She is the author of the National Employment Law Project's new report titled State Unemployment Systems in State of Disrepair. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about oral arguments in the Supreme Court over the prayer issue.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He is the author of the new book, Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. And he has an article at the Daily Beast, Supreme Court Prayer Decision in Greece versus Galloway Should Be Easy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Siegel.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And I'm not sure it is easy. It looks as if, based upon the oral arguments in the Supreme Court on Wednesday, it doesn't look as if they know how to handle this and they'd rather have it go away. At least that's my reading. What was your reading on it?
Well, it's definitely not easy for them because they're not willing to accept what I think is a relatively easy answer, which is pretty rare in constitutional law questions. No, they were very torn today. Justice Kagan began the hearing with a great question today. She said, would we be allowed to start our sessions at the court with a prayer that said, you know, God save Jesus and the Holy Ghost and this court? which is basically what the town of Greece, New York, did for about 8 years. And the answer to that is obviously no. If the Supreme Court did that, I think everybody would be uncomfortable. If the Supreme Court can't do it, why can Greece, New York do it? And I think that question got the justices off to a rocky start, and frankly, it went downhill from there.
So, well, I wanted to ask you, though, just because we're talking about the Supreme Court, to talk about the premise in your book, since I read the title out, and it's a provocative title. Can you just quickly give us a very brief sketch of that?
Sure. My perspective on the Supreme Court is that from 1803 and the very first constitutional law case, Marbury versus Madison, until today, Supreme Court justices do not act like judges in the sense that they don't rely on prior law to make their decisions. We expect judges, no matter where they are, in the United States, any Western country, to not make all things considered decisions, but to try to figure out what prior law says. Now, prior law is often vague, and judges definitely have discretion. But most judges do take prior law seriously. I go through the history of the Supreme Court in my book, and I think demonstrate that the justices do not care enough about any kind of prior law, text, history, or precedent, to warrant calling them judges. It's a provocative thesis, but I think I back it up.
Well, I'd say the Citizens United decision is definitely a grist for your mill.
Well, sure, because we know for certain that the Founding Fathers would never have thought in a million years that corporations could have free speech rights, or for that matter, religion rights, which you know is going to be an issue coming up to the court soon. The justices like Scalia and Thomas, who say they believe in originalism, don't, because there are many, many cases in Citizens United, affirmative action, all kinds of other cases where they don't go
to the original intent
because it goes against the policy results they would want. But let me be clear about this. Although I am a liberal and I am on the left, this thesis applies to all the justices, left, right, and center. They, you know, when you give somebody life tenure, you know, they have lifetime terms, and their decisions are unreviewable. People have a tendency, no matter how good their character, to think that their views of the law are what the law ought to be. They are the only public officials in the world, in Western countries, that have life tenure and virtually unreviewable power. That's a crazy job description. It really is. And even judges with great characters are going to be corrupted by that job description. You wouldn't want to give your boss life tenure and unreviewable power, would you?
I can't answer that question on the grounds that it might incriminate me.
Well, let me put it this way. When I go around talking about this book, we would never give a dean of a law school, we would never give the chairman of Exxon, we would never give any other U.S. official both life tenure and unreviewable power. So that combination is a deadly thing for most people.
So, again, I'm speaking with Eric Siegel, Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of the new book, Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and the Justices Are Not Judges. And he has an article at the Daily Beast, Supreme Court Prayer Decision in Greece versus Galloway Should Be Easy. And returning to Wednesday's oral arguments in the Supreme Court over this separation of church and state case involving this town in New York where they had this prayer, and two people in the town brought this suit, one of whom I think is an atheist, the other one is Jewish, and it's now argued in the Supreme Court. But what I take it is that because there were so many conservative organizations, I think it was 120 members of Congress, almost all Republicans, had amicus briefs, and 18 states attorney general, Senator Marco Rubio, attended the hearings in the Supreme Court. And my understanding is that conservatives want the court to broadly hold the government endorsement of religion that it never violates the First Amendment's Establishment Clause unless the government is actually coercing religion.
I think that's right. I think that is the view certainly Scalia is going to embrace in this case. But, you know, it's really – so if we were to talk about abortion or affirmative action or guns, we would have a very difficult conversation. On this issue, a moment of silence does all the work that prayer does with none of the bad stuff. If if the Speaker of the Assembly stands up and says, to dignify the occasion today, I want to have a moment of silence where everybody can reflect on anything they want to reflect. People can pray. People cannot pray. They can pray to one God, three gods, no gods. And that would be a way to solemnize the occasion and make it a serious one. I'm in favor of that. The only thing a prayer does is it adds religion to that moment of reflection, and now we have all kinds of problems. How proselytizing can the prayer be? How diverse do the prayer speakers have to be? The Supreme Court was wrestling with all of these issues. Are references to God going to offend atheists? And there's no good answer to any of those questions. So why not just have a moment of silence? And Ian, if I may, I wish this case wasn't being litigated in the courts, because if I had the city council in front of me, I would say, what's wrong with a moment of silence? That's what they did prior to 1999. The Greece City Council had moments of silence prior to 1999. And I think that's what schools have, by the way. That's the rule the Supreme Court has come to when it comes to public schools. Prayers, no. Moments of silence, yes. It's just the right thing to do. It doesn't offend anybody.
Well, I think you can take it further, too. I think that all of these arguments mostly come from conservative evangelical Christians who feel, in a way, that they are under siege, which is certainly not indicated by the facts in this country. The idea that, Rush Limbaugh's brother wrote a book suggesting that Christians were persecuted in this country. If you watch Christian television, and then, you've got these guys who look to me like hucksters.
Can I tell you a really brief story what happened to me 2 days ago on CNN? Cause it makes your point. I was on CNN on this case 2 days ago, and I was getting, my makeup on, and the woman said to me, "What are you here to talk about today?" And I said, "Legislative prayer." And she said, "What's your position?" And I told her, "I just told you about moments of silence." And she gave me a really dirty look, Ian. A really dirty look. And I looked up at her and I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I don't agree." And I said, "Okay, tell me what your opinion is." And she said, "You don't want to hear it." I said, "No, I do." And she said, quote, "It's a Christian country. If people don't like it, they can leave." And she was a very nice woman, so I'm not suggesting, but I think there are a lot of people who feel that way. And I wanted to say to her, first of all, there are hundreds of millions of non-Christians, but more importantly, Christians are going to be a minority in many communities pretty soon. And a neutral principle that says the government will stay out of religion in the long run helps all religions. But her view was, look, we're Christian, don't like it, leave. And that's just, I think that's a very dangerous view.
Well, I was going to say that, the conservatives who are pushing the idea of this coercion test that Justice Scalia is in favor of, they also, of course, are obsessed with prayer in school. And to my mind, the way to fix prayer in school is to teach comparative religion, which would give kids a menu of religions, in effect, to choose from. And that's, of course, the last thing that Christian evangelicals want, because they, in spite of all of their efforts to appear to be fair in all of these arguments, they basically want their religion to be supreme.
I couldn't agree more. And as a constitutional doctrinal matter, without getting too much into the weeds, the free exercise clause is the coercion part of our Constitution. The government is not allowed to put you in prison for your religion. It's not allowed to tax you more because of your religion. It's not allowed to coerce religion under the free exercise clause. The establishment clause has to mean something else other than coercion. Otherwise, there's no reason to have it. And what that else is that, the government should not sponsor religion in a way where the government take sides. And in Greece, New York, for 8 years, from 1999 to 2007, 100% Christian prayers. 100%. Over half of which had specific references to Jesus, the Holy Ghost, and so on. So that's the government playing favorites. And that's what the Establishment Clause is supposed to prevent.
Well, there was an odd moment in the Supreme Court oral arguments over this case that's at the heart of the separation of church and state, where Justice Scalia asked about devil worshippers.
Yeah, he's obsessed with the devil these days, and I don't know what that's about, to be honest with you. Several times in the argument, Justice Scalia said, made jokes about atheists that were extremely condescending. They really were. You can tell, even off a transcript, you can tell how condescending they were. And the point he was making is we can't compose prayers for everybody, including devil worshipers, so we should just let it all go. Well, that's the wrong conclusion. The conclusion is if we can't, you know, make prayers for everybody, which we can't, we shouldn't have them in the government. I think his point is a correct one. You can't find a prayer that's going to please everybody. His conclusion, allow all prayers. My conclusion, don't have any prayers in the government.
Well, Scalia wondered whether the ruling from the court would leave, how it would leave non-believers. He said, what is the equivalent of prayer for somebody who is not religious? He asked the attorney for the plaintiffs, the two women from Greece, New York. And Justice Breyer then stepped in and said, perhaps he's asking, because the guy didn't answer the question. So Breyer steps in and says, perhaps he's asking me that question and I can address it later. So what do you think?
Isn't there an obvious answer to that question?
Right.
A moment of silence.
Right.
You know, when we go to baseball games or football games and there's been a terrible tragedy, inevitably there'll be a moment of silence, you know, to remember the people of the tragedy, you know. Why isn't that the answer? I mean, you know, 50,000 people in a baseball stadium having a moment of silence is a very powerful thing. And I am sure that during that moment, people pray. Let's start the Supreme Court, the Congress, legislative sessions with a moment of silence where we reflect on the importance of what we're about to do. Why does it have to be mixed with prayer?
But Senator Marco Rubio, who attended the hearings in the oral arguments in the Supreme Court, and of course he's running for president, and I think it's probably no accident that he's showed up there today and was on television quite a bit. He's arguing, of course, that they start sessions off at the Senate with a prayer. So, you know, that's his point.
Well, they do, but there's two things. First, I don't think those prayers very often refer to Jesus or to Moses or to, you know, they're non-denominational prayers. But Ian, there's a big difference between Congress doing it. How often do citizens go to Congress to conduct business? The answer is never, I think. And a city council doing it, where if you want a zoning permit or a zoning variance or you want to, you know, challenge something the town is doing, you have to go there. So I'd ask you to picture either a Jewish person or an atheist or a Muslim who arrives at the city council, and right before his business starts, there's a chaplain of the month. That's what they're called, chaplain of the month, who asks everybody in attendance to bow their head and thank Jesus for all that is good. How would that make you feel if after that you now have to conduct business? If you don't bow your head, it's a sign of disrespect. If you do bow your head, you're doing something you don't believe in. We shouldn't put American citizens in that situation. It's just wrong.
So what was your sense then of the sort of closing arguments, if you will, from Justice Kagan, who basically said that she'd like to find a way to live in a multi-religious society in a peaceful and harmonious way. And every time the court gets involved in things like this, it seems to make the problem worse than better. Again, it looks like, you know, your answer is staring her in the face. Nobody brought this up.
So Douglas Laycock was the lawyer for the plaintiffs. He's a University of Virginia law professor. He is very smart. And he's been doing this a long time, and he's one of our leading religion law experts in the United States, which is why he argued this case for the plaintiffs. And I think he made the decision that there was no chance he had five votes for a mandatory moment of silence. So that's the strategy he came up with. I think he's right. I think, sadly, although I think it's an easy question, and I think as a policy matter it's an easy question, there aren't five justices who are going to buy it. So that being the case, I think Justice Kagan is trying to minimize the damage. I will say this, Ian. My thesis about the Supreme Court generally is that when it tries to force change, there's often a very bad backlash. I am the most pro-choice person you'll ever meet. I met my wife through Planned Parenthood. I worked for Planned Parenthood at times. I think Roe versus Wade was the worst thing that ever happened to the left in this country because of the backlash. So I have sympathy. If the court were to come down and say absolutely no prayer at legislative sessions, what would happen? I think there would be a huge public outcry. And I'm not smart enough to figure out the politics of whether the court should do that or not. I want legislatures to do that on their own, to come to that conclusion on their own, that a moment of silence has all the benefits of prayer without any of the offense to people who don't believe in any religion or the religion that is being prayed. I think what Kagan is hoping is for a rule that it has to be non-denominational, that generic references to God are okay, but references to specific religions or specific deities are not okay. There's a chance there'll be 5 votes for that, and that will depend on Justice Kennedy. I think there are 4 votes for that result, and again, Justice Kennedy, as he usually is likely going to be the swing vote on that question.
But I guess what's going on here is that the votes against it, the votes on the conservative side, the more conservative side than Kennedy, and he's a pretty conservative guy, they represent the constituency that's going to be outraged no matter what, right? Is that fair?
Well, they'll be outraged unless the court says, you know what, we're not going to enter into this fight. Do whatever you want as long as you don't, quote, overtly proselytize. That's what a couple of courts have already held. Where I live in Atlanta, the 11th Circuit, the highest court next to the Supreme Court, had a case like this, and that's the result it reached, which was you can say anything you want. We're not going to look at the prayers because government officials shouldn't be involved in censoring prayers, which I agree with, by the way. So anything other than overt proselytizing is okay. The problem with that is that's still a line that has to be enforced. It seems to me 8 years of Christian prayers in a row, every single one, if that's not proselytizing, I don't know what is.
Well, Eric Siegel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Eric Siegel. He's a professor of law at Georgia State University College Law. He is the author of the new book, Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. And he has an article at the Daily Beast, Supreme Court Prayer Decision in Greece versus Galloway Should Be Easy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.